Hello. Is everyone okay? Are you feeling all right? Welcome to the Beyond the Event Horizon edition of Romaniacs. It's Wednesday afternoon in London, England. What a drama there. Last night, the Commons rejected the May deal by the largest margin in parliamentary history, 230, thumping the previous record of 166 in 1924. Jeremy Corbyn's no confidence motion is being debated as we speak, and it's expected to fail. And we are here to try to answer the question that keeps on giving, what the hell happens now? Good title for a book.
That would sell well. I should do that.
With me are two of our regulars. There's Ian Dunt, editor of politics.co.uk, and Naomi Smith of Best for Britain. Hi, Ian and Naomi. How are you feeling today? Refreshed?
I mean, I liken working on Stopping Brexit to people who have told me about becoming a new parent, that you suddenly are able to function on such low levels of sleep that the former parent you would never, ever have believed. Yeah. You seem to somehow find resource from somewhere to carry on, even though you have had precious little sleep at all. If you told me a year ago that I'd be able to function the way that I just about to do on the levels of sleep I've been getting, I would not have believed you. So refreshed is probably not the right word.
What were the vibes like in the Best of Britain war room?
Amazing, because our whip count was exactly spot on. We got the 202 figure exactly right, which was a huge relief for us, because obviously a lot of what lobbying is about the confidence you've got in the quality of your relationships with the people inside the different camps feeding back to you and the whips and things like that. So yeah, we were really buoyant. Obviously it is step one. We always knew, well, not always, but you know, we've known for a long time now that deal wasn't going to get through Parliament. So it was a sort of big, you know, pat on the back to everybody involved, but not taking foot off the pedal.
Ian, you have been touring the new studios, finding new ways to say that nobody knows what's happening. What were the highlights of yesterday's Dunt media onslaught?
There were no highlights of that. My personal highlight was, to be honest, it wasn't the vote. It was the point where they just started, everyone started saying, right, we're not going to do the amendments. So, you know, first of all, Jeremy Corbyn, and then Blackford, and then whoever the fuck else it was that was doing ones. And it was just quite extraordinary moment, because you'd had this actually quite impassioned speech by May. It started off as mechanical and shit as ever, and then just started to improve. When she attacked Corbyn, I was like, oh, that was actually quite eloquent. And the first thing I've heard you say that was entirely true from start to finish for about 2.5 years. And even after that, they suddenly, you could see the animal, because you got these beating drums outside and you got the crowds outside chanting as well, it did feel like, you know, you're at like the execution of Charles I. and so then suddenly, you know, immediately I was just like, no, we're not doing the amendments, we're not doing the amendments, we're going to get straight down to the killing now, please. And off it went. And that actually felt like, that was quite full on.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly think that the front pages today are all slamming May, every single one. And that is, I think, scapegoating her when the real bogeyman is, of course, Brexit itself. So I'm never one to feel much sympathy for Theresa May at all, largely because of her time in the Home Office and Windrush and all of that. But and those racist go home vans. But I think, yeah, the editors of the pages have got a lot to answer for, because this is about the whole political discourse having to shift to saying it is Brexit that is the awful thing here, the unachievable thing, not simply this government's inability to deliver it.
It's like that last part of Raphael Bayer's last piece, where he was just like, it's still fucking Brexit. You know, it was a shit idea in the first place. It is a shit idea now. Could it conceivably be that all of these complications are due to the fact that the original idea is terrible? And the answer to that might arguably be yes.
To help us unpack yesterday's head-spinning events, one of our favourite guests is back. David Alan Green is a lawyer, writer, FT columnist, supernaturally prolific tweeter, and the artist formerly known as Jack of Kent. David's appearance on Romaniacs last year was one of our most popular shows, and his challenge today is to describe what happens next without using the phrase, by automatic operation of law. Hi, David. Welcome back. How are you?
Oh, thank you, and thank you for inviting me back. Last time I was on this show, people tweeted saying I didn't sound as authoritative as I read as a tweeter. They thought I'd sound like Brian Blessed rather than a cross between Ozzy Osbourne and Julie Walters.
I think they're acclimatised now.
But yeah, I'm happy to try and give some sort of legal or policy view on what happened yesterday. As Ian said, it was an extraordinary show, especially when the first three amendments looked like as if they were feints on the ball. and went straight through. And the Rips could not have been expecting that. They probably thought they had an extra hour of arm twisting.
Mm.
And then suddenly, they won for that vote.
I know. There was me back at HQ thinking, right, we're going to be launching new campaign at this time because the vote will be at this time. And then all of a sudden it was like, no, we'll have the result 40 minutes earlier. And it was like, crap.
As someone who tries to maintain an objective stance on Brexit, did you find it exciting, entertaining?
From a point of view of somebody interested in constitutional law and history, it's absolutely glorious. You have to really look back
someone's
a very
happy.
Long time before you. It could have been this fun to be a constitutional lawyer or historian. It's probably the 1680s before you actually have this amount of sheer confusion in the polity.
And last time you were on, you broke a few hearts by being firm on the idea that we're on the rails towards Brexit by operation of constitutional law. And there's just no time to organise another vote. Has anything changed your mind about the kind of irrevocability of that?
There's certainly not enough time to have a vote before the 29th of March on any of you. Mm-hmm. There's not enough time to do any legislation. Even if the vote had passed yesterday under the Withdrawal Act, there has to be a Withdrawal Deal Act passed before the end of March. And that hasn't even been published in bill form yet. And there's lots of other pieces of legislation which aren't in existence in any form. So I can't see a vote happening before the end of March. Could one happen with an extension to the Article 50 period? Of course. Depends how long the extension is. But the last piece of referendum legislation, and it'd have to be primary legislation, took a year from beginning to end, including all the statutory instruments. And part of the problems with the last piece of legislation was that the SIs, the statutory instruments, weren't terribly good. That's why we had all the spending rows, the voter registration panic halfway through the period, which led to some urgent legislation. It's not easy to legislate at speed. So I'm afraid, for various reasons, I'm opposed to a referendum, because I think referendums are part of the problem, not the solution. But even if there's an extension of the period, I don't see a referendum likely if it's an extension of only a few months.
On that first part that you said, does that mean that it's sort of, in your opinion, even if, let's say, that somehow by some magic Theresa May gets a deal through in the next week, you would probably still need to extend Article 50 just in order to get the primary legislation through?
Yes, I think, given the provision in the Withdrawal Act, which provides for the meaningful vote, which we had yesterday, Section 13 of the Act, another one of the preconditions, there's four. One is that the deal and the political declaration is put before Parliament. That's been done. The second is a meaningful vote. The third is that there's a motion in the House of Lords. That shouldn't be too difficult, as it's... But the fourth is that there actually has to be an act passed by withdrawal date embodying the withdrawal agreement. And for some reason, that still has not been published. It's almost as if they want to sort of shove through a two-line or three-line bill, just like the notification legislation, at speed, once they get it through, perhaps in a few days. But no, there's a lot more to be done, even to keep that. So, yeah, it, being rational, you would need an extension in the normal course of things.
Naomi, you're emphatically not opposed to another referendum. what's your response to the timetable question?
I think what we're seeing at the moment is the breaking of all kinds of precedent. Think about how many unprecedented things have happened in the last year. A vote of no confidence in the government. Her rip-roaring defeat yesterday, I think, the 1926 figure, is it 1924? 24 figure. Date has been bandied around, but I think perhaps there could have been something even further back. But, everything at the moment is unprecedented. All the rules are being torn up in terms of what we're expecting to happen. And what we know is that nothing happens without political will. There's absolutely no majority within the Commons for any one form of Brexit. So that's why we are where we are. And there is currently no majority for a people's vote yet either. But there is political will to absolutely say no to no deal. And crashing out is going to be allowed to happen. I don't think our MPs are that spineless and awful and going to let that happen. So the 29th of March is looking, incredibly unlikely as our absolute exit date. The EU is making all the right noises, as it has done all the way through, about an extension to allow for a second vote. That probably means us standing in the European elections in June, and some of the political parties are beginning to look at their candidates for that and select those. So I just think we need to, yes, of course, understand the constitutional framework within which we have to operate, but alongside that, think about the human emotion of all of this that is driving the decisions of most of the politicians. And we're seeing unprecedented things happening all the time, so we just can't lose the faith that we can get this, because once there's political will for it, which we're hoping there will be in the coming weeks as campaigners from the front bench of the Labour leadership, it is very likely that we could somehow make it happen.
We'll be getting into all of that in a minute, but first, Naomi gets to unwind for a few moments by doing the reminders.
First up, some big news for Patreon supporters. We are starting an extra fifth episode of Romaniacs every month from the beginning of February. When we ask listeners for questions for our popular Ask Romaniacs section on the show, we can never fit them all in. So we've decided to spin Ask Romaniacs off into its very own show. A bit like the Knots Landing or Torchwood or Hollyoaks Later. You know, that one that had all the adult content. The monthly Ask Romaniac special is going to cost us a little more to produce, so it will go to everyone on the $5 a month tier and upwards. So if you haven't signed up to back us on Patreon yet, it's a pretty good time to start. If you're on the $2 a month tier, then it's a good time to move up a gear and get access to the extra show and get that coveted Romaniacs mug, a renowned conversation starter in offices up and down the land as well. We're recording part of the first Ask Romaniac special next week, and we'll be asking Patreon backers for your questions. Just search Patreon Romaniacs or go to our Facebook page to find out how to sign up. And don't forget, the very first Romaniacs Live of 2019 is at the Leicester Square Theatre in London on Thursday the 7th of February. Special guest David Schneider of The Death of Stalin, The Day Today and Alan Partridge fame will be joining me, Ian and Dorian to discuss the latest Brexit nerve shredders. It's a whole 3 weeks away and anything could happen by then. Tickets are going fast at leicestersquaretheatre.com and of course Patreon backers get a discount. That's Romaniacs Live on Thursday the 7th of February. Tickets at leicestersquaretheatre.com. And search Patreon Romaniacs or go to our Facebook page to find out about that extra show.
Thanks, Naomi. Now, there's only one topic in town, and we're going to start by asking, as David Bowie did, where are we now? David, you're the guest. You thought that May's deal was a way to sort of purge the poison of the referendum and its mandate. That doesn't seem to be happening. Well, is that a loss?
Well, looking at this from the point of view of somebody who is neither a Brexiteer nor a Remainer in principle, but just somebody who wants something which is sustainable between the UK and the EU, it would appear to me that if the UK is going to leave, then the deal would have been a sound basis for departure, not least because it would keep so much in place which could then be converted into an association agreement, which in turn could last even longer than the actual membership we had in the first place. So that seemed to be saying that you could actually have a sensible relationship with the EU, stay part of a single market to a great extent, be part of a customs union, and then on the other hand, meet the inverted commas mandate of the referendum. And it does seem to me that one way of purging the poison of that extra parliamentary mandate from our political system is to discharge the mandate on the narrowest terms possible, i.e. we are not members of the European Union anymore technically, and then hopefully we can start recreating a sensible, sustainable relationship with the EU. Had I been a Member of Parliament, yesterday I would have voted for the deal. But that's no longer sensible politics. The deal now looks, at least in anything similar to its current form, to be dead.
And Ian, we expected it to die, but perhaps not to have people stamping up and down on its twitching corpse to quite such an extent. I mean, when something like this happens, which is both huge but also anticipated, what's your sort of takeaway? Was there anything about it that wasn't that wasn't anticipated, or anything perhaps around the edges?
I think the glee and the extent, you know, because I was sort of thinking it'd be more like majority defeats, like 150. I wasn't expecting it to be quite so severe. I wasn't expecting them to be so keen to just to kill the shit out of it in the way that they did. So that
They killed it to death.
And that has political implications, right? Because of course, if it was a more modest outcome, if lots of people had abstained, we would have a different conversation now. We would say, you know, maybe there is a chance that something could be done. People looking at a bit of what Angela Merkel was saying the other day about the backstop, she seemed to shimmer a little bit on how hard she was on it. We might be having a different conversation. I don't think it would. We were never going to have a conversation that the EU was going to get rid of the backstop, and I don't think Theresa May was ever going to get it past the Commons with the backstop. So you still have that problem, but ultimately the conversation will be different. The conversation now, because of the manner and the extent to which it was killed, means that May's deal is dead. Dead, dead, dead. Okay, so there's no more talking about that option in any way. There's now only three options. There is no deal, there is people's vote, and there's a change deal. And the change deal, by virtue of what the EU says, cannot be opening the withdrawal agreement. That is not going to happen. So it has to be about what can you put in the future relationship to try and bring people on board. And that's obviously where Theresa May is right now. My guess is, if you listen to her in PMQs today, Jeremy Corbyn didn't notice that she was avoiding the question because he is a fucking cardboard cutout of a human being who has no capacity for comprehension or reasoning. But she kept on refusing to say that she would not make the customs union permanent. Mm. Now, he missed it completely and started talking about fucking adult education or God knows what. But she's right there making it pretty fucking clear, I think, that she will move on that. The question then becomes, will she move to an extent that would allow Jeremy Corbyn to support the deal? And I think that whatever she does, even if she was to take his own speeches line by line, put it in the fucking future document and go, now will you support it, given that these are all literally your words? I still don't think he'd support it because he doesn't want to be tainted by the thing. And that makes a deal of any sort really, really hard to foresee.
David, do you think she has to come back on Monday, I think, with plan B? Is that just going to be plan A with a pair of glasses and a fake moustache?
Well, going on her time as a Home Secretary, every setback she ever had meant that she just try again harder. And as Home Secretary, she actually wasn't terribly bad at that. She shoved through the investigatory power legislation, even though the Snoopers Charter stuff meant it didn't go through the first time. But just to disagree with Ian in a more Midlandy and less expletive-ridden way, Ian presented three things as options, as if they were co-equal, but in fact, it's like a ball rolling down the slope. We are heading towards no deal. We don't have to do anything else. That is where the ball is going to roll to, unless something interrupts the fall of that ball down the slope. Question is what could possibly do that? I remember the euphoria of people when the Article 50 vote went through. There was claps and cheers. There were claps and cheers last night, but looking at it from a sort of law and policy point of view, all that happened yesterday was that it made no deal Brexit more likely than it was before, to a significant extent. One of the options which would have avoided a no deal Brexit is now off the table. And Ian's right, I don't think the EU will want to reopen the withdrawal agreement. But even if it did, things like the backstop would still be there. Mm-hmm. The things which made the withdrawal agreement objectionable to a significant number of MPs would still be there, even if the EU reopened the withdrawal agreement. So what the vote for was yesterday is there is not going to be a Brexit on the basis of a deal, because any possible deal was ruled out. And we can't have a no-deal Brexit. So the only obvious place to go to is that we've got to pull the whole process altogether. And I'm not with Naomi on the referendums, because there's no point us yet again, like in 2016, going to a referendum where we're not prepared for a Leave vote again, which is what we'd be. We should just act in the national interest. If we're not going to leave on the basis of a deal, we should just be pulling Brexit altogether.
You're sort of... It's like you're from this parallel universe where there's no politics, which is really enticing, because then things are just done kind of like, you know, on the basis of kind of law and sort of logic and what's best and all of these kind of things. And I think that you've been very harsh on people who voted for Article 50, because that was a case of them doing the politically right thing to signal to voters that they took the result seriously without thinking of any of the implications. So just it's like politics does rather keep getting in the way.
Well, yes. Well, if you want political commentators, there's loads of them.
No, that's why it's refreshing, because
my unique selling point is I'm not particularly interested in party politics. I'm just interested in the mess. I'm not even interested in black letter law. If you want black letter law, you go to all the brilliant law bloggers. I'm just somebody who likes policy and legal messes and trying to understand how they're going to turn out.
And what you just said is obviously true. Like, the default status is no deal. That is where we're going unless something changes. But that is understood, I think, by MPs. So while at the moment there is no majority for anything else, I do think that no deal majority holds and is the strongest majority that exists in the Commons. That does not mean that they will definitely stop it. I'm always a bit alarmed. Like, I hear a lot of the sort of the flip side of your perspective is the sort of the Remainer sort of view, usually Remainers, who say, not just Remainers, actually, some Brexiters too, who just say there will definitely not be no deal because nobody wants it. And you just think, no, I mean, it's perfectly possible through the chaos and the way that law works that that's where we end up. However, I do think as these weeks go forward, enough MPs recognise that that is the default status for them to find something that has a majority, whether it's a kind of deal, which I don't think is impossible, or whether it's another referendum, or whether it's just whether it's just basically saying to the EU, but help us now, please. We're just going to extend it while we have an emotional breakdown.
But when we look at what that kind of deal could be, and we look at what happened yesterday, that's where May is totally snookered. So she had 7 of her own payroll voted against the deal. So, you know, even people who are on the payroll. So what do? You do a deal that will bring some people and lose others, bring those and lose the former. Like, it is a case of absolute snookering within Parliament. So that's, you know, the options are an election, whether that is a general election or a referendum. Obviously, Jeremy Corbyn is very much hoping for a general election. I don't think there is the appetite amongst the MPs to back that. Who knows? And then that general election, would that then be fought on the basis of what? Because at the moment, the Labour Party doesn't have a position on Brexit. It just has its process, which is we will vote against the deal. We will then try and get a general election. And when we can't get a general election, then we will consider supporting a second referendum. But if they were to get a general election, we do not know what their Brexit policy would be. So I don't agree that I think that there is much likelihood at all of the Commons coming together to try and broker some kind of deal, because the numbers just don't stack up for it.
I think it's unlikely as well. But today has been notable for the things that people have been saying. So Barnier came out and sort of said, look, you can move those red lines whenever you like. And if you do, then we're going to offer something different. That's obviously talking about the future relationship document. You hear the same sort of thing, obviously, from the Nicky Morgans, from these people who are connected, their fellow travellers, to the People's Vote guys. But ultimately, they're on the side of, you know, of Norway, really, and of a single market relationship. Now, there's enough chatter around there. And that's obviously where May's instinct is, because she's written herself out of ever being able to do a People's Vote, for them to try to pursue that and see how far it goes. It doesn't seem to me to be very likely to get very far, because for a start, Theresa May isn't even willing to invite Jeremy Corbyn to the fucking meetings when she supposedly reaches across the aisle, which is an extraordinary failure of vision. But secondly, I can't see Jeremy Corbyn supporting anything, even if it was exactly what he wanted. And then thirdly, let's say she did offer customs union, workers' rights, environmental standards and a closer relationship to the single market. Her vote does not stand still. She doesn't necessarily keep those 200 MPs. She will probably lose about 50 of them.
Absolutely.
Tory members fucking hate customs union and all of that. So on the numbers, I can't see it either. But I think we'd be wrong to discount it, because at the moment, it's an even more palatable option for most of the people in Westminster and in Brussels. So they're going to pursue to some extent. And that, I think, will be where the debate is, at least for another couple of weeks.
And don't get me wrong, David, I don't think there are many of us in the Remain movement that are, you know, desperately in love with referenda. We are not. And, you know, I think there is wholesale...
Referendums.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, exactly. We are with you on that. You know, none of us, very, very few of us, believe in that kind of plebiscite democracy. However, you know, just trying to see a route out and the whole, you know, having it not be completely dismissed. But were there a way that we just revoked Article 50, my God, we would all take it. Of course we would.
Well, this brings us to the thing that's given me a tension headache, as officially diagnosed by my GP, which is the Labour position. Now, there's I've heard the phrase "all options, including a second referendum, will be on the table" so many times that I now can't even look at a table.
And how do you feel about options?
I hate them all. I hate every word in that sentence, including A. And the problem is people go back and forth, and some people go, this clearly locks, you know, because there are no other options, this clearly locks Labour into a second referendum. But then you think, well, if it did that, then they would have said that. And obviously the wording, the vagueness of the wording, gives them these loopholes. I mean, if the no-confidence vote fails, it was assumed that it's like, well, surely you've got to, you know, go for a second referendum or have a very good reason why you're not. But now there's rumours that he's just going to keep putting forward no-confidence vote. It seems like literally anything. He will literally do anything rather than back a second referendum. What's your... I don't want to kind of look inside his dusty attic of a brain for answers, but I do wonder, like, what's your feeling of kind of movement in Labour and the frustration, because there's enormous frustration, obviously.
Dawdling, I think, is his approach to getting to where we would all like him to be on a people's vote. This morning, which is Wednesday morning, we've seen, I think, about 75 Labour MPs do a photo call on the steps of Portcullis saying that they are all in favour of a people's vote. I'm not quite sure how many of them are new, but I think it's a relatively significant chunk. We've seen GMB move quite a bit this week as a union, not exactly where we want them to be, but certainly further along. And we even, I think, have seen Len McCluskey from Unite saying, you know, our position remains that we're against this, but if there's a referendum, we probably would back Remain, which is actually quite a big move. So it's never quick enough, it's never fast enough, it's always achingly slow, but the trend and the direction of travel is slowly, 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 and time is the one thing we don't have, which is probably what David's going to remind us of.
But the risk of trying to remind Remainers what they are, I think you should have the confidence of your Remain principles and stop arguing for a second referendum, which may well still go against you and cause even more chaos, and actually just say, let's just go and close down this process in the national interest. It's gone on in the wrong direction. Okay, if you want to have Brexit in the future, then let's have another referendum then. But at the moment, this process has come to a halt. There is no good way out of it. Why don't you just clamour now and just say, let's get this over with, let's just revoke Article 50?
Because that seems even less politically possible.
And also democratically, because the thing is, nobody likes referendums. But once you've opened the box with a referendum, I think it's really hard to close it without using that as well. I think it would, you know, it's dangerous enough as it is. And in fact, the instant answer, and we're going to have to, if it was ever secured, a lot of people, before they even started listening to the arguments on the EU, a lot of voters, their first question would be, why the fuck are you asking me again? And that is a hard thing to get past. I think if this was done without holding any other democratic vote, I think that would be... I would be quite concerned.
But what would you guys do if you had this further referendum you're all clamouring for and you lost it?
Well, and you lost it.
Yes.
Well, the idea is that you've... Well, OK, fine. At that point, you sort of are going to have to accept what's going on. But first of all, you fight for your country. And if you see something that is taking place that looks like a disaster for your country, if you see something that is tearing your country apart, making it poorer, reducing its status, closing up all of the best qualities that it has, and making it a closed-minded and a kind of cold and hard-faced place, then you fight the fucking thing.
And to fight it,
you need some kind of democratic process. You can't have a stitch up in Westminster, but you've got to fight for your country.
But what would the predicament of the country be if you had this referendum and you lost it? Would you be saying we would leave without a deal? Would you say that we had to somehow renegotiate a deal? What would be the practical consequence of your referendum taking place and you yet again losing it?
So that obviously depends on what ends up on the ballot paper. And it seems to be perfectly possible that you are going to have to go for three-way. There's really good arguments against that. And I think we heard them last week, actually, by the pollster, who was sort of going, look, that makes it really quite complicated. It means you're going to, as soon as you get three options, you see people start gaming the system. And it makes it harder to see that the result is, you know, has that overpowering mandate because the numbers are lower and whatever selection comes out. But nevertheless, that does seem, I have to say, probably I get pushed more towards that element. But ultimately, that's the question of what do you put on the ballot paper? And those have to be specific options. I do think that has to be the point where you draw the line of they have to be deliverable and doable in a relatively short time frame.
And I mean, surely also if another referendum was fought and then lost, I mean, that would change MPs' behaviour. I mean, I wouldn't be pleased with that result. But I mean, in a way, that would be a way out of deadlock.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
I mean, not the way that I would like. Yeah. But at the moment, I think sometimes every time I hear a criticism of a referendum idea, it's not that I disagree with it, unless it's kind of just one of those stupid claims that it's undemocratic, you know, mm-hmm. but dismiss them. But a lot of these kind of things of, well, what happened, you know, couldn't the campaign end up being really nasty? What happens if we lose? Referendums are a bad idea. But it's just, you look at all of the options on the piece of furniture that's not a table, and it's just, I think, still the least worst that is doable. Because in the world where there is, you know, in the world of sort of politics and people feeling that they've expressed a point of view, I think simply revoking it in Westminster, as Ian says, is just untenable. So I suppose it's not as if, I don't think anybody, even on the People's Vote campaign, is besotted with the idea and thinking this is going to be like all my birthdays have come at once. It's just like, how do you get out of this?
When we launched our manifesto at Best of Britain in the middle of last year, which was our sort of roadmap to how you get a people's vote, how the hell are we actually going to get one at a time when it just didn't seem like there was any possible way through, and we set this out, we were very, very clear in saying that if we are privileged enough to win the right to have that second referendum, the campaigners have to say from the outset that they commit to living with the outcome. And then we laid out our citizens' jury model and the much more deliberative approach to how that referendum has to be run next time, so that people are making a much more informed choice. And that's why I really like the stuff we hear from the doctors like Sarah Williston and Philip Lee, which is that informed consent is a prerequisite to doing any procedure. And we did not get the informed consent of the people in 2016. And next time round, we would absolutely have to make sure, through much better mechanisms of communication with voters and laying out the facts of what each of those options mean, if there are three, then, you know, being much, much, much clearer with that. And I think we would all have to commit to that at the outset and say that we would have to live with the results of it and campaign like hell. But as Dorian says, the alternative is too bleak, even if it's not a great thing to have to happen.
Absolutely. The alternative is awful. Where I'm a bit concerned at the moment is how likely, I mean, really, where we are in Parliament. So I didn't like this thing this morning with the Labour guys. I thought that was really badly handled, and I think that they really threw away an opportunity there. So they send, you've got to be careful with the lobby, because the lobby admires power. Okay, so government can get away with a lot with the lobby. They can do all sorts of shit, and in fact they fucking do, and the lobby never raise a goddamn whisper. But if you're a campaign, if you're any kind of campaigning sort of movement, they will shit on you whichever chance they get. And there was real mistakes. I mean, they were sending out stuff yesterday. It was like, we're going to have 100 MPs outside and it's going to do this. You turn up and there was basically, I think, a few dozen. There were 75 on the list, but there wasn't 75 outside. There was like, I think maybe like 35, 40 of them. Then they send out, they give us a list. The list has got a bunch of names. It doesn't say which names are new and which are old. So you're making journalists do work. Never make journalists do work, because they fucking hate it. And they'll get in a terrible strop with you for having to do it. When you get to the end of it, there was like, I think less than 10 of those names were new. So you've had to do a lot of work to find out that the claims are being egged on a bit further than they are. And then you sit down as a journalist and you start doing the numbers. And you think, so let's, and then they're saying, well, look, okay, fine. So they're not all going to go outside. They're not all on this list, but there are the other Labour MPs. So there's maybe 100, 115. And so we've got 100, 115. We've got a few SNP. We've got a few Plaid. We've got a Green. We've got 11 Lib Dems. That does not give us a lot of numbers. It doesn't even get us up to the 200 that we had for Theresa May's deal yesterday. Now, of course, that's slightly different because that's a government putting something forward. It's not quite the same thing. It's a baseline from which to start moving in that direction. But this morning felt like they were cocking it up a bit, and they were deflating their own sort of momentum, and it was going to have the opposite effect on Corbyn than I think it might have.
Dave, what do you make of the Labour leadership's strategy on this?
I really have no clue. I'm not a party political commentator.
No, but that's why I'm interested, because obviously the analysis of that is always through a party political lens. But in terms of, as you say, what is best for the country? What is best for this process?
Well, the one question I have for you guys is, a few moments ago, Dorian, you derided Theresa May's Plan B as having a false moustache and glasses on. What I'm trying to understand is what the Remainers' Plan B is if you don't go referendum.
Well, I mean, that's okay. I've never really understood that question, because that always seems to be, I think we talked about this last time, I think. That ultimately seems to me to be a sequencing issue. Mm-hmm. Whereas, so you get to the end of the process, you fight for what your optimal scenario is while it is attainable. And of course, that stops being attainable the moment that you leave the EU. You can have a let's go back in, but realistically, that's going to be 10 years, you know, something like that. So once you get out, then you fight for your suboptimal scenario, which to me is Norway, which I've been very clear about for a really long time. Now, right now does not seem to me to be the moment to do it, and also it doesn't seem like there's any interest in doing it. The second that it's no longer possible to remain, my message to anyone that was a Remain supporter is just get fucking behind Norway. You may have noticed I've spent most of the last 2.5 years getting Norway people to stop attacking second referendum people and second referendum people to stop attacking Norway people, because they all seem to me to be allies. They're fellow travellers. And each time that they attack one another, they undermine their own negotiating position if the circumstances change. So the answer is it's a sequencing issue. And then you go to your suboptimal outcome on the basis of where you are in context.
Got you. But as regards the Labour Party and parliamentary stuff generally, anything on the European Council has to come through HMG. So if the Speaker and a few desperate MPs turned up in Brussels waving a piece of paper saying, hey, we voted on this, here's a notification, the European Council would probably ignore it. It has to go through the government. Mm-hmm. So although Parliament may be asserting control, and if Parliament does adopt a determined and firm view on Brexit, you'll probably find HMG capitulates in the same way it did to the EU 27, because that's all it can do when it hasn't got a policy of its own. But if Parliament did do that, then we would probably need to have some ministerial changes at very senior level, because I think Ian is right. Whilst Theresa May is Prime Minister, I can't see public policy being any different from what it is now.
The one thing we've not talked about in terms of her getting more numbers for something, is if she does some kind of deal with the ERG on when she will go. They so desperately want to get rid of her that there has been some talk that she might do a Cameron the day after the referendum thing and stand on the steps and say, I will go on the 1st of May 2019 and take her deal tweaked with a moustache and fake glasses on back to, and that there may be enough ERGers who would say, go on then, if it means we know when we're going to get rid of you, fine, we'll back you for that. I don't totally buy into that, but it has been some, you know, bit of gossip that's done the mill, gone round the mill. And then there's also that she could just call the general election herself and say, all right, I need a majority to get this through Parliament. And what do the ERG do then? Do they stand on a manifesto that says we are effectively siding with this Brexit policy, which is her deal?
Yeah, that's interesting.
And that, you know, makes it very, very difficult for Jeremy Corbyn, because that's the one thing he's always said he wants. He's obviously performing very poorly in the polls, if you can rely on them. So there are these two other things sort of in the ether that may raise their heads and is, you know, worth thinking about.
Ian, obviously a lot of the problems here were kind of sown by, well, calling a referendum and the red lines and May's rhetoric, you know, from the start. Is there any way that she could have played this better? It seems like threatening one side with no Brexit and one side with no deal, presumably hoping that they wouldn't hear what she was saying to the other person, doesn't seem to have worked. Is there any way that you think that she could have minimised these losses, or was it all kind of set really quite a way back?
How could she possibly have played it any worse? So, I mean, from the very opening, the red lines she put down were fucking nuts. Okay, they were insane, and they were insane in the first place. The second she made that speech, talking about we're going to, you know, put labels on our own food, no ECJ, no freedom of movement, you're like, we're fucked. What you've just done is you've insisted this has to be an economically pulverising moment, and you're also, of course, saying by that, we're not going to reach out at all, because you're ruling out the single market. So, of course, all of that stuff is crazy. But then there's the deeper element of not challenging the myths. Now, yesterday, when you saw the Attorney General Cox was up in the comments, now, you can get past the fact that he's insanely theatrical and gripping to look. If only all of our fucking Brexit opponents were as interesting and enigmatic as he was, it would be a fucking pleasure to have this argument. Instead, it's like quibbling with a rock for the last 2.5 years. So he starts doing his points. But why was he so effective? At one point, someone gets up and goes, well, fine, we'll do no deal, and then we won't have to give them the money and borrow, because the money is really there there as a, you know, to get the deal. And his point was just like, no, it's not there to get the fucking, the money is there because that's the money that we owe them. Mm. It's not about anything to do with the future. And he was in a position to say that. Why? Because he hadn't fucking lied to everyone for 2.5 years, going, oh, of course, this is actually a ransom note by constantly throwing red meat to the ERG. If you do that, if you encourage their bullshit, you then are unable to turn around to them and go, oh, no, you know what, actually, if it looks and smells like shit, maybe it fucking is shit.
Yeah.
And the one thing she could have done would have been not call that snap general election and ended up with minority government.
That would have been a great
idea. That was her big effing mistake in all of this.
And then, of course, there's a presentational quality. There's the complete, again, look at that fact. She says, I'm going to reach across the aisle and then I won't invite the leader of the opposition. She is a walking fucking echo chamber. She doesn't understand what it is to reach outside the aisle because I do not believe, and I say this genuinely and I know it's not a pleasant thing to say, I don't really believe that she has the capacity for political empathy. I don't believe she has the ability to think as if she was someone different. When Labour MPs were called in to try and get them to support the deal, you had a bunch of guys that were just giving them Tory lines. They come out, these are people like Caroline Flint who should by any rights be supporting that thing. She's more than stupid enough to back Brexit in every possible way. Comes out and goes, why the fuck have you just tried to sell this to me like I'm a Tory? This doesn't make any fucking sense. And the reason is because she's incapable of thinking outside of her bullshit echo chamber.
What listeners at home will have missed are Ian's extraordinary hand gestures.
I'm so wary of my hands. Whenever I look,
gosh. Okay. There's something else I would add to Ian. Is something else which Ian's right. The Brexit was won and lost before the Birmingham speech. Hmm. There has been an allowance of fakery and misleading information to go up. But another thing which has really been disheartening is the contempt for independent institutions.
Yes.
Contempt of contempt for Parliament, contempt for the courts, contempt for the role of the Speaker. And also this contempt for people who actually may have known what they were doing. Ivan Rudgers and various other civil servants would have dutifully carried out their instructions, even though they personally would have disliked it. But that went, and it was a combination of this unthinkingness in every different way, which has led to Brexit being this insistence that a complex problem can be dealt with simply.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, there's a broader question I wanted to ask you. That last week, John Bercow became the Brexiters' public enemy number one for allowing a vote on the latest Grieve amendment. It's going to create a box set of Grieve amendments. The one that gives the government just 3 days to deliver Plan B, and it passed. And obviously,
collectibles.
It's just good at amendments, man. What can I say? Everyone's got a thing. And obviously, Brexiters were outraged at this kind of breaking of precedent. Yeah. And you called out their hypocrisy by pointing out all the times that their side enacted or tolerated similarly dubious or unprecedented moves. Now, we try on the podcast to kind of avoid double standards as best we can. But, I mean, do you think that Brexit has made almost everyone a hypocrite to some extent, that they kind of just get very, very angry when the other side does it? And so for you trying to be kind of, well, objectively, these are all part of the same thing.
I used to be partisan. I used to be a Tory. I was a Tory at Oxford with Jacob Rees-Mogg and Dan Hannan. And I remember Jacob Rees-Mogg when he undoubtedly heard the first Birmingham accent of his life. A great moment.
Did he ask you to get the drink? So?
No. Were you with the same era?
Yeah.
You look like his son. You literally look like his son. You look considerably younger.
Oh, thank you.
Look like Septimus or whatever his name is.
What is more, we all did the same degree. We all did modern history. I used to be a partisan. And one of the luxuries of being a commentator from my point of view is I can't even be bothered now with being partisan. I just try and focus on the principles and see if they're being applied. You are right. That means that politically I'm tin-eared. You know, I once thought it would be mad for any government to actually make the Article 50 notification. I've not been proved wrong, but they still did it. So it's very easy for somebody like me to say, hey, you're being inconsistent. But if you are taking the Constitution seriously, the repeated trespasses, which is the best word from my point of view, they're not quite violations, but the repeated trespasses of the current government on constitutional norms in trying to force through its Brexit policy has been remarkable. And if you have nodded along with all of those, you do not get, in my view, to argue from first constitutional principle about the Bercow thing. I think the Bercow decision on that Grieve amendment was actually right on its own merits. It doesn't need to be said, well, 14 rights make a wrong or 14 mm-hmm. wrongs make a right. You know, I think the House should have control over the business. And the only reason it's ended up like this is because the government has lost its working majority on Brexit. If the government still had its working majority on Brexit, it wouldn't be, it'd be a non-question. So that decision of the House was right. But if you are taking the Constitution seriously, then, yes, these are problem after problem after problem. And there are some Brexiteers who, to their credit, are honest. They say, we don't care for Parliament. We want the people's vote to prevail. But for those Brexiteers who have purported to say, oh, we want to bring back control of our laws to our sovereign Parliament and to the Supreme Court, when they're calling judges enemies of the people and putting back benches and the Speaker on front pages and deriding them, you just think, what are you throwing away here? Do you actually care? Because if Brexit is going to succeed, we will need an independent civil service to work. We will need independent judges to work. We will need our legislature to be a hell of a lot more effective than it has been for the last 30, 40 years. Do you sincerely want us to Brexit? And if so, stop trashing domestic institutions.
Can I ask a couple of questions on the back? I could have asked about 50 questions on the basis of what you just said. Let me ask.
Sorry, fewer hand gestures.
Okay, you got me there. The first one, on the Brexit, on the Bercow decision, lots of the constitutional people I spoke to obviously would sign up to everything in the argument you just said about the general thing. We're still quite uncomfortable with it on the basis that he was going against a business motion that had been passed by the House. So in other words, he was giving MPs power that they had sort of signed away, that only ministers could amend it. Hmm? When you say it's right, do you just mean like it was the right time for someone to do something unprecedented on point of principle? Or do you think that there was actually precedent there that he was able to rely on?
No, it was a novelty. And to the extent it was a novelty, it was welcome. To the extent it went against precedent, it was welcome. A lot of the government... A government too often forces through stuff on the back of business motions because they know they can't actually be amended. So, yeah, it was good. Hurrah! You know, the House of Commons has got taken back control of its own agenda.
My other one was personal. What happened with the partisan thing? Did that change overnight, or was that like a long, slow process of untorification?
I just realised there'd been a social liberal all along. And it was really when Cameron came out against the Human Rights Act, and I just thought, actually, this doesn't seem to make sense. And then when the credit crunch happened and I realised free markets didn't go to equilibrium but actually went towards disequilibrium, I thought, right, whoopsie, no point me being a partisan anymore. But I'm fascinated by policy and policy failures. I'm a former government lawyer. I used to be the lawyer for big, huge government projects like the IT, NHS IT project, the ID cards. And I've seen project failures and policy failures on the inside. And that fascinates me. And that's why I'm not a party partisan, because it can happen under any party. And so when Brexit happened, the morning after the referendum result, when all you guys were crying, I was going, well, wow, this is the most fascinating mess I will ever be able to write about, because it's so interlocking. Everything is thrown up in the air because of Brexit, and it still hasn't settled.
You're like the sort of surgeon peering in someone's brain and going, guys, I've never seen a tumour like this. Check it out. I could win a prize for this tumour. Before we move on, I just want to ask...
You like that description?
Fine, Eddie. Anything for a lawyer is a compliment.
Because this really has been like power going back to Parliament and really kind of, you know, the leaderships of both parties, you know, someone's being eclipsed by backbenchers. Naomi and Ian, could you quickly both choose like an MP who over the last few days of debate you think has really sort of stood out as impressive in terms of their kind of rhetoric or their canniness? I mean, I suppose obviously we should, you know, Greaves are given. But this does really seem like, you know, it's the backbenchers' era.
For me, it's probably Clive Lewis. He spoke very passionately on Monday night at an event in Parliament that was, I think, probably aimed at the Labour leadership, and obviously he has got a shadow front bench portfolio, and just, you know, making some brilliant comment about the next referendum and how it would need to look and feel so very, very different. And I think hearing those voices that are so close to Jeremy begin to say that stuff is really useful. So if you're asking me for a name of somebody I hadn't previously clocked as being particularly impressive, I would probably go with him.
Ian?
I can't really pick. I mean, my obvious thing is I want to say King Clark is just such a fucking obvious thing to say.
But I was going to say Lammy and Thor Khan.
Right. I was watching today, right? Today, you're looking at PMQs. It is just fucking pathetic. And your brain, yearning for some kind of justice, can't help but imagine some inquiry later on where people ask what the fuck happened with Brexit. And you pull these MPs in and go, why the fuck are you asking questions about fertilizer when this is the scenario that we're in? And then at one point you just get King Clark stands up and you get that sense of the substance of him, but you get that on a physical level. You get that sense of there is weight, there is political gravity, there's experience there, but then you get a sense of independent judgment. So he'll stand up and you can see him, because remember, he supported May's deal. You know, obviously he's about as Remain as it fucking gets, but he sat there and he supported May's deal. So he's got a right to speak on that basis. He's earned it for himself. And then to go, look, I can see it here on customs union. I can see your movement here on single market. Can you be pushed? And that comes from having an autonomous approach to politics and that kind of political weight that allows you to deliver it.
Just on Dominic Grieve, and you've said it's a given, but Dominic Grieve is a QC, is a barrister. As a litigator, one thing you do is litigation is a process. It's a long process, sort of a number of stages. And what you do, say, at one stage, like, for example, exchanging witness statements or putting your cases in, you do with an eye to pick up on something later.
Mm.
A bit like playing chess. What? I'm sure it's all totally above board but just an accident. But what happened this week has its origins in pushing through the meaningful vote months ago.
Yeah.
And I would not be surprised if at the time they moved that meaningful vote amendment, which was incredibly opposed at the time, emphatically opposed, Grieve had already fought through the Burko amendment thing, knowing full well that at a later point he will then come in and actually ask that these sort of motions can be amendable. That sort of foresight is what you'd expect from somebody like Grieve, and actually contrasts with the sort of very blunt one move at a time playing of the ERG. And that is why I would say Grieve and others have actually outfoxed the ERG on parliamentary procedures, because they have been thinking in this complex structured way as opposed to in this sort of knee-jerk reactive way the ERG have been doing.
Interesting.
And just not to let all the glory go to just boys, I think it's worth shouting out to Tulip Sadiq delaying the arrival of her own child to vote the way she did.
Yeah.
Hear, hear.
Okay, so whether we escape exit day or not, David, where do you think the EU is headed now?
The EU have been terribly polite and saying they would very much like us to stay. But you do get a sense that the EU would be well to be shot of us, and that they can see a sort of EU plus UK relationship. And perhaps in a lot of things around the world, we would be at once saying EU plus UK, and we get so used to doing that sort of shorthand. Way back in 2016, just after the referendum result, I went round Brussels. I mentioned this on my last show. And I went round asking people, you know, if the UK was not a member, what would you be wanting from the membership? Why would you want the UK to be a member? And they couldn't think of anything straight away to say. It was not as if they had this vision of UK being an integral part of the EU. I think the EU are so glad, in a way, that the UK, which has been a drag on so many things with opt-outs and various things, no longer will be a problem within its councils. And so, in a way, Brexit would be good for the EU, even if it's not for the UK. If the UK changes its mind, I'm sure the EU would be fine, but they're not desperate to make us stay.
Which is why so many of the leave arguments have been utter bullshit, because it has been the UK that has been the liberalising force within the EU on so many issues. Mm. You know, we've not been their friend. We've been punching well above our weight in terms of pushing stuff through and getting our own way with everything, and helping to make it a much more liberal trading bloc than it has been. So I think you're right. but to the extent that, you know, let's use that back at the Leavers because it's just not true.
You always
all
see
their
that.
Claims about.
You often get like loads of Europeans talking that way of like we're better off without them. But then you see certain countries like Sweden or the Netherlands have usually relied on the UK sort of liberalising spirit, especially around services, things like aviation or whatever. Especially the Netherlands. I mean, we've been pretty strong buddies. In fact, historically, well, we invited them over to invade us. That's how close we are. You know, we get on very well.
Invite them again.
I would vote for that, actually. Yeah. So, I mean, and that more sort of distant relationship.
Plan F, Dutch invasion.
And so you have that. So the more sort of relaxed sort of European figures, the less sort of, especially less federalist ones. But even, you know, because of course in Germany there's a lot of protectionism around rare, blah blah blah. You know, they'll have this sort of attitude of it's a healthy voice to have in the mix is the British voice to make sure that the Germans and the French, who clash against each other but ultimately see the same way on, especially around protectionism, don't sort of get their own way. But I agree, lots of people in Europe don't talk that way. It's the more sort of academic, like, oh, isn't it better to have lots of voices?
I often feel like on both the Tories and the Labour side that we're kind of stuck in sort of like decades of kind of baggage and old battles, certainly with kind of the, you know, the kind of veteran Tory Eurosceptics. And on the Labour side, we're still talking about, you know, Corbyn's Euroscepticism, essentially Benite. Do you think that to have a really kind of the best possible relationship with the EU, if we were outside of it, it would require a sort of a new generation, a younger generation of politicians? That it would just take time to evolve a healthier relationship with Europe that wasn't kind of weighed down with all these historical battles?
Oh, I think that's patent. The post-war generation of politicians had, you know, two extremes. You had Benary and Powellism on the extremes, and then in the middle you had people who, you know, like Ted Heath and Willie Whitelaw and whatever, who had actually fought in the war and realised what was, you know, what was at stake. But that generation's not there. And somebody wisely said, I don't know who it was, perhaps even you know, is, you know, the real test for the European experiment is what happens when the people who can't remember the war are no longer in any way involved. I suspect in the future, where you were on Leave and Remain will probably be like the Tory and Whig of the 1680s. It will be a label which you will actually have for the rest of your political career. And it's difficult to see how the European issue is going to be extinguished. My view, for what it's worth, is that, you know, let's have a long-term sustainable association agreement. Let's realise it's all the EU issue is always going to be problematic in British politics. It's never going to get over war consensus. So let's have the strongest possible relationship, even if we're not technically member of the EU. I'd see that as a solution. I actually don't see as a solution us going back into the EU and pretending none of this actually ever happened.
But UK foreign policy for hundreds of years has been about making sure that neither France nor Germany or any one power within Europe had too much power. So what we've always been trying to forge has been a kind of a sustainable relationship where no one of those empires grows up too big. And so, you know, that's how we'd got to where we were with the current situation with the European Union. And that's why I find it so desperately depressing that somebody like Jeremy Corbyn, who is a self-proclaimed pacifist, can't look at the European Union as the greatest peace project in human history and embrace it for that, if nothing else.
But on the other hand, the other perhaps indirect consequence of all this is that, you know, we're going to end up with the United Kingdom coming to an end as a union of four constituent states.
Which is why I put the UK in the time capsule as the thing I'd miss after Brexit.
Did Nicola Sturgeon talk about independence this morning?
She was in the Commons. I didn't listen.
But, Scottish independence and United Ireland flowing directly from the Brexit decision would be wonderfully ironic for the so-called Conservative and Unionist Party. They've trashed the Constitution and they've broken the Union.
And then they should just get on with breaking up England into constituent fiefdoms and just getting them smaller and smaller and smaller.
Or we could have the United Kingdom of London, Scotland, Gibraltar and Northern Ireland. And then the rest could be Brexit land.
Don't forget poor old Exeter and
Bristol, Brighton. Yeah. We need to have somewhere to go to the sea.
Yeah, good old Liverpool.
But yes.
Okay, we'll get the maps out and start dividing it up. Build that wall.
But in a more serious way, such a constitutional spell has been cast because of all this. I cannot see the old constitution staying together. It's sensible Tories used to just be very, very reserved and hesitant about taking on big constitutional things because of the untold damage and unforeseen consequences.
Great. So the breakup of the UK will be another tumour for you to crack on with next.
Oh, it'd be absolutely fascinating.
I'm not sometimes having a supervillain. It'll be very interesting.
We're only at the end of a second season of this huge box set, which was set off, and as it currently stands, there's all sorts of untold consequences from the decisions which were made a couple of years ago.
It's nothing if not fascinating. And that's our show for now. Let's do the Brexit time capsule. David, Alan Green, what's going into our bomb-proof cache of things we'll miss or things we'll need if Brexit goes ahead? Well, you can't have the union because we've done that.
Well, last time I was on here, I said the one thing I wanted to keep from before Brexit to in the post-Brexit world was David Davis's reputation.
I was a
huge supporter of him taking on the establishment and promoting freedom of information and privacy rights and all sorts of things. This time, I think the sense of respect for balance and independence within our constitution, I really don't like this knee-jerk, let's trash any part of the state which stands up to what the government wants to do, whether it be judiciary, the speaker, backbenchers, the civil service, even the universities in having pro-Remain lecturers and things like that. It's not a healthy sign. And if Brexit is going to be on the basis of this sort of relentless government-mindedness, that is not a sort of taking back control, which I think anybody should welcome. That is just basically swapping the powers of Brussels and all the other elements of the UK state and giving it to Whitehall. So that is something I would like to preserve, along with David Davis's pre-Brexit reputation.
Thanks for coming in, David. You managed to do it without using the phrase automatic operation of law, which means you win a mug and T-shirt.
Thank you.
Now our foreign language clip, as we have some Latin still live and kicking from listener David Landon Cole.
Muri per Europa motolontur, non ilos i versus fidevimus in aevo nostro.
With apologies to Sir Edward Grey, he says, that's Latin for the walls are going up across Europe. We shall not see them down again in our lifetime.
That's fucking brilliant.
Thanks for the pep talk. Send us your sign-offs in a European language at info@romaniacs.com. Keep them relatively short and we'll use the best ones.
Fuck, I love our listeners. That was so many levels of... And then to do it in Latin.
I know.
What a genius.
I know David Landon Cole is a good bloke.
Oh, really? Right. Oh, okay.
That's the end of the show. Thanks to both Davids, both good blokes. Thanks to Naomi, Ian and producer Sophie. Don't forget Romaniacs Live on Thursday, 7th of February. Tickets are flying at leicestersquaretheatre.com. Now put your hands in the air for our theme tune, Demon is a Monster by Corner Shop, and a shout to some of our latest Patreon backers.
Hello from me to Christina Pagel, Mike Shepherd, Gabriel Barnett, Alistair White, Tony McGuinness and Richard Mand.
And a massive thank you from me to Kevin Henderson, John Miller, Christopher Armand, Roger Langridge, Ray Hall and Mark Brain.
Finally, thanks from me to Kirsty Newman, Daniel Rush, Tom Miles, Angela Henry, Adam Gordon and Matty Piccola. Thanks to all. We'll see you next week.
Romaniacs was presented by Dorian Linsky with Naomi Smith and Ian Dunt. The producer is Andrew Harrison, and audio production was by me, Sophie Black. Romaniacs is a Podmasters production.